This lecture is produced by Stone Kingdom Ministries of Asheville, North Carolina. Follow along in your Bible as James Brueggemann shares good news from God's Word. For a sample copy of our publication and a catalog of the resources available, write to Stone Kingdom Ministries, Post Office Box 5695, Asheville, North Carolina, zip code 28813. You may also visit us on the web at www.stonekingdom.org. Your regular financial support is what makes this ministry possible, and we are grateful to you for that. And now, here is Bible teacher James Brueggemann.
Turn to 2 Samuel 22. I have a lot of ground to cover today, so if I do not allow you enough time to get to the Bible passage, or if I talk faster than usual, it's because I know it's probably going to be a tight squeeze to get all this material on two tapes. Before I begin with the main body of today's lecture, I want to return for a few minutes to readdress a question I posed several messages back. I raised the question during our study of the sin of incest in David's family. Now, if anyone new on the tape ministry wants to hear that message, the tapes are number 422 and 423, and it's entitled All in the Family, Incest, Rape, and Murder. And at the end of that lecture, I was frankly stumped, and I asked for help. I asked, what about Abraham? Because the Bible has Abraham stating that Sarah was his sister. You remember that? And I got quite a few responses, and I, folks on the tape ministry, there were some very thoughtful ideas in them. Now, how many of you have read the book of Jasher? I've read it cover to cover several times. It's just a really fascinating book to read. But it's been a number of years since I read it the last time, so I decided to add it to my stack at home. And I don't know how you do it, but I generally have at least a dozen books at any given time that I'm reading. I rarely sit down and read one book straight through without picking up another one and reading part of it for a while. It's whatever mood I'm in at the time I pick up that particular book. Anyhow, I was reading in the early chapters of Jasher just a couple of weeks ago, and I came across the birth and early years of Abram, which are skipped over in the Bible. Incidentally, for the sake of new listeners, I should make it clear that while I do not consider the book of Jasher to be on a par with the Bible as being wholly inerrant, I do believe it is generally trustworthy, and it's one of the few books that are cited by the Bible as being a source book, or a source which confirms what the Bible is saying. I don't put any of the books of the so-called Apocrypha or the Pseudepigrapha on the level of the book of Jasher. For example, I'm convinced that the so-called books of Adam and Eve are fiction, written thousands of years after Adam and Eve, and yet I see some writers quoting them as though they were the Bible in support of their strange theology. If you're interested in all the background on those topics there, I deal with those types of books extensively in tapes number 17 and 18 of our 20-tape series on Bible versions. Those are cassette numbers 253 and 254 on our order form. So anyhow, there I am one evening reading the book of Jasher, really enjoying the story again about the early life of Abram, and there it was. In chapter 9 of the book of Jasher, it tells that Sarai was the sister of Lot and the daughter of Haran, who was Abram's oldest brother. Therefore, Sarai was Abram's niece. It's the same chapter which tells how Abram went and lived for 39 years with Noah and Shem and was trained by them in the ways of Yahweh. Now, when Abraham in the Bible calls Sarai his sister, it's clear then that the Hebrew word has an extended meaning which includes other female relatives. And someone might still ask, well, wasn't Abram still committing incest since she was his niece? Well, in fact, he was not, according to Leviticus 19, where all the types of incestuous relationships are listed. And you can read that at your leisure, Leviticus 19. So much for that. Now, I had intended this week to detour from our studies of Saul and David to deal more extensively with the idea of coming out of Babylon, which the part in the story we had got to of David had led us into that last time. But as I was studying the scriptures concerning coming out of Babylon, and I've done that many years ago in the past, but I was renewing that study, and I found many more things which now fit the picture, which I didn't realize earlier. And so I realized that if I started that, we'd never get back to the story of David. Now, we're so close to the end of the story of David and Saul that I'm going to finish out this series probably in the next message. That is, not today, but the next pair of tapes. And that will then give me more time to more thoroughly prepare for what will be then an extensive study, actually a series, on the idea of what should we do? Submit to Babylon? Should we, quote-unquote, come out of Babylon? Okay, so much for that. Now, if you're at 2 Samuel 22, you'll note that this is a psalm. Verse 1 reads, "And David spake unto Yahweh the words of this song in the day that Yahweh had delivered him out of the hand of all his enemies and out of the hand of Saul." What's the time frame here? When does it say this occurred? When Yahweh had delivered David from Saul and other enemies. Now, on several occasions, I've emphasized to you that some of the stories in the book of Samuel are not in chronological sequence. And if we think that's the case, it leads to confusion, because here we are way at the end of the book of 2 Samuel, and it's talking about a psalm that David composed way back at the time when he was protected from Saul and other enemies. So this psalm, though, is virtually identical with Psalm 18. And so after just a couple of remarks, we're going to skip over it. Not because it's not important. Everything in the Scriptures is important. But we're going to skip it because, number one, we're anxious to conclude the series. And number two, this is essentially a psalm of praise and thanksgiving. Therefore, there's not a lot of action or historical stuff here which lends itself to the type of study we've been engaged in ere these many months. We've been focusing on the lives of Saul and David and comparing their respective character traits. We can say this, though, as a point of contrast. How many psalms are attributed to King Saul? How many did King Saul write? None that we know of. David, on the other hand, was known among his people as the sweet psalmist of Israel. Although he was a man who fell deeply into sin on several occasions, he nonetheless had a heart for God. One of the ways this is demonstrated is through the dozens of psalms that he wrote, all of them extolling Yahweh and his mighty deeds. David always attributed his successes and his own personal safety through his many life and death battles. He attributed that safety always to the Almighty One of Israel, as shown in just the first several verses here. Verse 2, "And he said, Yahweh is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, the God of my rock, in him will I trust. He is my shield and the horn of my salvation, my high tower and my refuge. My Savior, thou savest me from violence. And I will..." Does this sound familiar? "I will call on Yahweh, who is worthy to be praised." You almost hear the song in your head, don't you? "So shall I be saved from mine enemies." Okay, let's move on now to chapter 23, 2 Samuel 23, verse 1. "Now these be the last words of David. David the son of Jesse said, and the man who was raised up on high, the anointed of the God of Jacob and the sweet psalmist of Israel, said, The Spirit of Yahweh spake by me, and his word was in my tongue." These are not literally the last words of David. Those will be found in chapter 24 and in 1 Kings 1 and 2. But these are David's last words in the sense that they are David's legacy. They're his last words in the sense that you remember Jacob Israel giving the prophecy about his 12 sons, a deathbed oracle. Or Moses gave his quote-unquote last words to Israel shortly before his death. Notice also that quite matter-of-factly there in verse 2, David is claiming divine inspiration for these words. Now verse 3, "The God of Israel said, the Rock of Israel spake to me, He that ruleth over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God." Let's analyze that. Here are given two chief attributes of a godly leader. He must be just. That applies what we say horizontally That is, how a ruler relates to his fellow men. He must be just, fair, equitable in the administration of the law, not perverting justice for bribes, nor abusing his power and trust, that was the power entrusted into him. David no doubt made many mistakes in his 40-year reign over Israel and Judah. And of course, we recall it wasn't all over Israel and Judah. The first 7.5 years was just over Judah. But yet, his reign was a vast improvement over King Saul's 40-year reign, wasn't it? One of the themes of the past couple of U.S. presidential elections was summed up in a slogan of the Republican Party that character counts, or character matters. Indeed, it does. One of the prime qualities of an outstanding leader is that of humility and submission before God. This is the second attribute given in verse 3. A ruler must govern in the fear of God. Now, that's the vertical aspect, from man to God. A leader must always recognize that he is only in his office because God placed him there. If the leader is willing to always seek God's guidance and direction on all matters, the state of the nation will be generally prosperous and happy, unless the good leader happens to come into office during a time of national punishment for the sins of previous generations, in which case it is still infinitely better to have such a godly man leading the nation. Now, the contrast between Saul and David are many. Saul had very few good qualities, and even these seem to have evaporated as he succumbed more and more to the evil spirit over the years. David seems to have been just the opposite. He had many excellent character qualities, with probably only a handful of areas of character where he failed. And as we've seen, these were very serious failures. And although David repented of these sins, he reaped the whirlwind of consequences throughout the rest of his life. Most specifically, as some of his own worst character traits, along with some of Saul's, manifested in the lives of several of his own children. Absalom and Amnon and Adonijah, whose story is coming up shortly. How tragic and how sad. Let us never think to diminish the long-term consequences of our sins. Yes, when we confess our sins, Yahweh is quick to forgive us, but that does not always erase the consequences. One can think of hundreds of examples today, but an easy one for all of us to understand is the case of, let's say, a young man who chooses the gay lifestyle. It's so ironic, isn't it, that the homosexual community would choose to use the word gay to describe their lifestyle? Because it is almost always a life of great pain and suffering brought about by the refusal to repent. But let's say that a young man has practiced the gay lifestyle for 10 or 15 years and then is brought to the light of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And let me make this personal for us here in our Atlanta congregation. If one of you folks, or if I knew somebody who had this personal history and who had recently got saved, quote unquote, as they say, and if one of us invited him to our fellowship here, now, I don't want you to answer out loud here and now, but I want you to think about this. Would you welcome that man into fellowship with us? Would you feel uncomfortable welcoming him, especially if he still possesses some very effeminate traits and habits? And by that I mean if he talked in the stereotypical gay voice inflections, or if he used very effeminate hand and arm movements. Could you welcome this former sinner into our midst? Now, I'm not posing this question because I have somebody like that in mind that I'm going to bring next month or next year. I don't. But I've thought about it as a possibility someday. And I want you to think about it also. Perhaps we can share our mutual ideas during the fellowship time later today. But I was making up an example of a man who had left the gay lifestyle after 10 or 15 years of engaging in that sin. And let's say that he truly forsakes it all, acknowledging and confessing his sin, and he's now a true believer in Jesus Christ. First, is he forgiven? No, absolutely. Of course he is. Secondly, My point is that just because he's been forgiven does not mean that he won't reap the bitter fruit from the seeds that he's sown. We read of many of the quote-unquote gay men dying some very unpleasant and lingering deaths from AIDS. There's nothing gay about that lifestyle or death style. And again, the point of this whole illustration is so that we would never underestimate the seriousness of sin, as though our attitude could be such that we would think, well, I'll just commit this sin this one time because I really want to do it, and later I'll just confess it. Not a good idea. David only seduced Bathsheba once, and he could only arrange the murder of Uriah one time. And yet, look at the whirlwind of pain in his family in the years following. Let us always remember that all sin brings consequences of one sort or another. Back to our text. Speaking of the excellent leader, David continues in verse 4. And he shall be as the light of the morning, when the sun riseth, even a morning without clouds, as the tender grass springeth out of the earth, by clear shining after rain. That's a beautiful simile, isn't it? A fitting figure of speech to describe a godly leader, as the light of the morning on a cloudless day. It could also be seen as prophetic of the Messiah himself because of the prophecy of Christ in Malachi 4, which reads, you don't need to turn there, Malachi 4, verse 2, but unto you that fear my name shall the sun, and that's spelled S-U-N, of course it means Jesus, shall the sun of righteousness arise with healing in his wings. Hebrew word really means rays, the rays of the sun, with healing in his rays. And ye shall go forth and grow up as calves of the stall. So verse 4 then is also prophetic of Christ's body, meaning the overcomers, who will also fulfill the promise of perfect leadership, ruling in justice and in fear of God in the kingdom age. Well, up to this point, David has been speaking in general. Now he gets specific in speaking of his own family and of God's promise to make it a dynasty, or as the Brits would say, a dynasty. Did you ever hear him say that word? It's a dynasty, you know. Let's stay on schedule here, shall we? Okay, 2 Samuel 23:5. Although my house be not so with God, yet he hath made with me an everlasting covenant, ordered in all things, and sure. For this is all my salvation and all my desire, although he make it not to grow. If you're using one of the more modern versions, in fact, in almost all of them, you will note a difference of 180 degrees in the translation of that first clause. For example, the New American Standard says, instead of, although my house be not so with God, truly is not my house so with God? And the New International Version gives, is not my house right with God? Well, after all these months of our study of the history of David's family, his house, what do you think? Is his house right with God? I don't think so. Except in the sense that David goes on to say that even though his dysfunctional family has been excellent material for Hollywood soap operas, nonetheless, God has a covenant with David and with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob before him. And by the terms of that covenant, it's obvious that God will work his perfect plan despite the failings of man. God will work through all of man's moral mud to bring forth shining pearls of character in people by the time we get to the end of the story. That is to say, his story or history. And now David speaks in generalities again, verse 6. But the sons of Belial shall be all of them as thorns thrust away, because they cannot be taken with hands. I think one can interpret verses 6 and 7 as either referring to bad rulers or to bad people in general. They are like thorns in contrast to the tender grass in verse 4, which springs forth from the earth after a gentle rain. Now, incidentally, the term sons of Belial is simply a metaphor. Belial means worthless, wicked, not profitable, or base men. But the man, verse 7, but the man that shall touch them, meaning thorns, must be fenced or protected with iron and the staff of a spear, and they shall be utterly burned with fire in the same place. The picture here is that if you're going to deal with the thorns in your gardens or whatever, you need to use some kind of rod or some kind of spear thing to push them away so that they don't, you know, rip your arms all up. So that you can sort of push them into bundles and so that they can be cut down and burned. This is also prophetic in that the wicked thorns, the tares, other thorns, that the wicked will be, as it says in the book of Revelation, ruled with a rod of iron and ultimately cast into the lake of fire. As we know, the lake of fire is neither literal nor eternal. The boys of Belial are raised at the great white throne judgment to be sentenced to live in the lake of fire. But that lake of fire is on the earth. You see, it's not a lake. It's a condition where those sinners will find themselves under the charge or supervision of the overcomers. The lake of fire is a place or condition of judgment, of disciplinary correction, so that the thorns, the wicked, will also ultimately learn righteousness. Because it says in Isaiah 26:9, "For when thy judgments are in the earth, the inhabitants of the world will learn righteousness." At this point, the last words of David are concluded, at least in this passage. And the writer of 2 Samuel now takes up an entirely different subject, which is a discussion and a list of David's mighty men. The mighty men are the elite warriors, the best of the best. These men and their deeds are still remembered 3,000 years after David. There appears to have been two ranks or orders or classes or companies among the mighty men. There was a group of 30, and above them, a group of 3. We will also notice that there are several groups of 3 mentioned, and finally, the last verse concludes by saying 37 in all. Now, keep in mind that the individuals who made up these groups were not static over the lifetime of David. Some may have died in battle, some may have retired, and they were replaced. And so if the number of the names is 37 rather than 30, or the names don't add up to 30, we're not too concerned about that. Verse 8, "These be the names of the mighty men whom David had. The Tachmonite that sat in the seat, chief among the captains, the same was Adino the Eznite. He lifted up his spear against 800, whom he slew at one time." Wow. He had his Wheaties, didn't he? Or maybe it was barley cereal. "And after him was Eleazar, the son of Dodo, the Ahohite, one of the 3 mighty men with David, when they defied the Philistines that were there gathered together to battle, and the men of Israel were gone away. He arose and smote the Philistines until his hand was weary, and his hand clave unto the sword." In other words, he was gripping that thing so hard that his muscles kind of froze in place. He couldn't unloose his hand from the sword. "And Yahweh wrought a great victory that day, and the people returned after him only to spoil. And after him was Shammah, the son of Agee, the Hararite. And the Philistines were gathered together into a troop where there was a piece of ground full of barley. And the people fled from the Philistines. But he stood in the midst of the ground and defended it and slew the Philistines, and Yahweh wrought a great victory. 13. "And 3 of the 30 chief went down and came to David in the harvest time under the cave of Adullam. And the troop of the Philistines pitched in the valley of Rephaim. And David was then in an hold, and the garrison of the Philistines was then in Bethlehem." So this is going back quite a ways, isn't it? "And David longed and said, Oh, that one would give me a drink of the water of the well of Bethlehem, which is by the gate." Now, I don't imagine he was really saying that real loud as though it were an order to his men. He was just kind of depressed and sitting there in the cave of Adullam, and he's going, "Oh, what I wouldn't give for a drink of water from the well of Bethlehem." Well, upon that, verse 16, "And the 3 mighty men brake through the host of the Philistines and drew water out of the well of Bethlehem that was by the gate, and took it and brought it to David. Nevertheless, he would not drink thereof, but poured it out unto Yahweh. And he said, Be it far from me, O Yahweh, that I should do this. Is not this the blood of the men that went in jeopardy of their lives? Therefore he would not drink it. These things did these 3 mighty men." Well, that short story has inspired many a sermon. I've not heard this idea before, but if I were developing a sermon around it, I would link the water of the well from Bethlehem to the living water from Jesus, the fountain of life, who did spring from Bethlehem. David likens the water to the blood of the three mighty men because it was so preciously fought for. Therefore, David poured it out as a libation, which means a drink offering. So too did our greater David pour out his own blood from the cross on Golgotha, or Calvary, a most precious sacrifice, all so that we might imbibe his spirit as the ever-living water. Verse 18. And Abishai, the brother of Joab, the son of Zeruiah, was chief among three, and he lifted up his spear against 300 and slew them, and had the name among three. Was he not most honorable of three? Therefore he was their captain. Howbeit, he attained not unto the first three. And Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, the son of a valiant man of Kabzeel, who had done many acts, he slew two lion-like men of Moab. He went down also and slew a lion in the midst of a pit in time of snow. And he slew an Egyptian, a goodly man. Doesn't mean he was a virtuous man. It means he was a man of great stature, big guy. And the Egyptian had a spear in his hand, but he went down to him with a staff and plucked the spear out of the Egyptian's hand and slew him with his own spear. These things did Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and had the name among three mighty men. He was more honorable than the 30, but he attained not to the first three, and David set him over his guard. Well, we've run into Benaiah several times in this very connection, that he was in charge of David's secret service, as I like to call it. Most recently, we ran into Benaiah as we read the list of the top officials in the administration for David's second term, as we called it. In other words, after he came back, after Absalom had tried to commit the coup d'etat, and after Sheba had been put down. We read this back in 2 Samuel 20, verse 23. You don't need to turn there. Now Joab was over all the host of Israel, and Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was over the Kerethites and the Pelethites. Now remember that the secret service was actually composed of the foreign legion, because we noted many messages ago that the Kerethites and the Pelethites were not Israelites. Nevertheless, their loyalty to David was unquestioned. Surely they also had become proselytes to the God of David as well. Verse 24. Azahel, the brother of Joab, was one of the 30. Elhanan, the son of Dodo of Bethlehem. You see, now there's the mention of David's nephew, Azahel, the brother of Joab. And we recall that he was a rash young fighter who unwisely tried to kill General Abner and got himself killed in the process. And that goes back a long time, doesn't it? Because that happened just as David was about to become king over all Israel and Judah. So it again shows that this list of mighty men goes way back to the early part of David's reign. And of course, we saw a moment ago, it extended even back further to the time before David was king at all, the time when he was still branded as an outlaw, and he was fleeing from Saul in the wilderness when the three men risked their necks to get David a drink from the well of Bethlehem. Well, now we come to a list of the names of the mighty men, and I'm looking to save time today so I don't exceed two tapes. And so we're going to skip down. Verse 39 says, Uriah the Hittite, 30 and 7 in all. We had made special note also back in our lectures concerning David's fornication with Bathsheba, that because Uriah was one of the elite mighty men, that in the subsequent cover-up, David was not sending some rank-and-file soldier whom he didn't know to his death, but he was sending someone that he had to have known very well on a personal basis. Just as another note of review, we recall the fact that Eliam, in verse 34, was Bathsheba's father, and that made Ahithophel her grandfather, and thus Ahithophel's bitterness over David's seduction of his granddaughter Bathsheba may have been one of the reasons for his betrayal of David during Absalom's attempted coup d'etat. We now come to another very famous incident in the life of David. We're going to be in 2 Samuel 24. We really cannot say with certainty when this incident occurred. I tend to think it occurred somewhere in the late middle, or perhaps even somewhat close to the end of David's reign. We're probably going to title this pair of tapes, The Blessing from the Illegal Curse. The Blessing from the Illegal Census. I guess I'm thinking blessing and curse. The blessing from the illegal census. 2 Samuel 24:1. And again the anger of Yahweh was kindled against Israel, and he moved David to against them to say, "Go, number Israel and Judah." This is an example of another one of David's personal failures, but let us not miss the fact that God, it says, God is angry with whom?
Israel.
God is angry at the nation. And in order to bring about a chastisement, it says that he moves, he incites, God instigates, God provokes, and lures David to take a census. How many of us think that just because God moves David to do something, that David's going to do it? Some of you think that God moves David and David's not going to do it. Well, you didn't put your hands up. I think he will. Keep your marker here and turn over to 1 Chronicles 21, because the same story is told there, and we're going to go back and forth and interweave these two accounts. So have a sturdy marker in both places. Look at this first verse. And Satan stood up against Israel and provoked David to number Israel. What's the shocking difference between the two accounts? Anybody?
One says the devil made him do it.
One says the devil and one says God.
The devil made him do it.
My goodness. So in one account, God is acting, and here it says Satan is provoking David. You see, this is another prime example of the sovereignty of God. We used this in our series on the sovereignty of God, but it's well worth repeating, this time from a little different angle. We noticed that in the account in 2 Samuel 24 that God takes the credit for moving David to sin. Here it says that Satan provoked David. The Hebrew verb is the same in both accounts. It could have been translated by any of those other words that I used. God moved, he incited, God instigated, God provoked, God lured David to take a census. And here, Satan moved, he incited, he provoked, he instigated, he lured David to number Israel. For the point of theology we're making here, it does not matter one whit whether you believe the Satan here is some supernatural, invisible, personal being or fallen angel, or if you believe Satan is simply an adversary of the human variety. The Hebrew word Satan, transliterated as Satan, simply means that, an adversary. Now drop down to verse 8. At some point after David has ordered the census, he's convicted of sin. Notice whom David blames for the sin. And David said unto God, is that what it says in verse 8? Are we in 1 Chronicles? I didn't mark 1 Chronicles, I just got verse 8 in my notes. Okay, David said unto God, I have sinned greatly because I have done this thing, but now I beseech thee, do away the iniquity of thy servant, for I have done very foolishly. Let's assume, for the benefit of those who believe in a supernatural personal devil, that the Satan here is just that. Can you see that there are three levels of responsibility involved in this evil? God caused it, Satan caused it, and David caused it. See that? Did David sin? Did David sin? Yes. Of course he did. He says he did. And God punished him. So I think we can safely assert that he did sin. Now exactly what was wrong with taking the census that made it a sin, we'll discuss a little bit further on. But we've now established the fact that he did sin. David did not try to evade responsibility for his sin. He forthrightly admitted it. He didn't complain to God, "Hey, that's not fair. The devil made me do it." Like little children say, "Devil," D-I-B-B-L. Nor did he complain to God that you made me do it. Now, what we're doing here is a tiny refresher course on the sovereignty of God. And if there are folks on the tape ministry who've never heard our series on that, I cannot urge you strongly enough to obtain it and study it thoroughly. It can change your life by changing your whole outlook on life. It's our cassette album A102. Now, we don't have time here to give you detailed proof of every statement or assertion we're making in this little section. If I raise questions in the minds of newer listeners, that's good. I mean to. I hope it will pique your interest enough so that you'll obtain the album. So just as part of a tiny review here, let me ask you, who created evil?
Yahweh.
Amen. Way to go. That's right. Isaiah 45. Is David responsible for his sin?
Yes.
Yes. But he has only limited liability. In this case, the liability is limited to a certain number of Israelites who will die of a plague or pestilence. Now remember that 2 Samuel 24:1 told us that God was upset with Israel. And it is true that God could have simply punished the nation without having David sin here. But you see, there was another purpose of God being played out by having David sin. Therefore, God caused David to sin, and then he punished Israel. Now, please, if you're new, I didn't say God sinned. God never sins. I said God caused David to sin. If that shocks you, that's why I'm trying to pique your interest to listen to the series. Now, from David's perspective, human perspective, could he freely choose either to take the census or not? Say yes.
Yes.
Yes. Some of you are shaking your heads. Thank you. I'm glad we all agree. From his perspective, he had free will. And he chose to sin. And that's why he has to accept limited responsibility for the sin. Only to a limited level. Because from God's perspective, did David have free will?
No.
No, he did not. Because God had foreordained that David would commit this sin. God foreordained that it was going to be the means of a great blessing. Good out of evil. God does that all the time. What that great blessing was, you will see by the end of the message. What about Satan then? Is he responsible too? Yes. But he's just doing his job, isn't he? He is, in fact, the agent of God whom God ordered to provoke David, just like in the book of Job. He, Satan, is responsible to God to carry out the mission of provoking David to sin, just like in the Garden of Eden, too, by the way. If God didn't order Satan to do this provoking, then you're telling me that Satan is an independent creature who is outside of God's control. Can that be? Now again, we don't have the time to rehash all the implications of this here today, so that's why we encourage you to study our Sovereignty of God series. Okay, end of review. Let's continue on with the story. 1 Chronicles 21, verse 2. And David said to Joab and to the rulers of the people, "Go number Israel from Beersheba even to Dan, and bring the number of them to me, that I may know it." What was David's sin? What is so wrong about taking a census? Moses did it. So we know there's nothing inherently wrong with taking a census. I think it's possible that David's sin may have been twofold. Here in this verse, I think, is our very first tiny hint of what one part of the sin of David was. He just wanted to know, out of vanity and pride at the strength and size of his armies. Joab sees through it immediately and tries to dissuade him of this folly. Verse 3. And Joab answered, "Yahweh make his people 100 times so many more as they be. But my lord the king, are they not all my lord's servants? Why then doth my lord require this thing? Why will he be a cause of trespass to Israel?" You see, that tells us that Joab knew this was a sin in the making. Although Joab was a predominantly rotten character, we have nevertheless seen him do the hard and dirty work when David was unwilling to face it. At the same time, though, we saw that Joab was doing the right thing with a wrong personal motive most of the time. But here it appears that Joab is entirely morally correct. Verse 4. Nevertheless, the king's word prevailed against Joab. Wherefore Joab departed and went throughout all Israel and came to Jerusalem. Thus, in this one verse, we're told that David was not persuaded, that Joab undertook the census and came back to Jerusalem. Now let's go back to the historian's account in 2 Samuel 24. Remember, keep a marker here. Now back to 2 Samuel 24, and we want to pick up some of the details that the chronicler omits. 2 Samuel 24, verse 2. For the king said to Joab, the captain of the host, which was with him, Go now through all the tribes of Israel, from Dan even to Beersheba, and number ye the people, that I may know the number of the people. Why did King David want to know? I think it was pride. David was looking to have the actual numbers so that he could boast and exalt himself and bask in the glory of his massive armies. And Joab said unto the king, verse 3, Now Yahweh thy God add unto the people how many soever they be, an hundredfold, and that the eyes of my lord the king may see it. But why doth my lord the king delight in this thing? Notwithstanding the king's word prevailed against Joab and against the captains of the host. And Joab and the captains of the host went out from the presence of the king to number the people of Israel. There we are given the tidbit that David was not only arguing against Joab alone, but against the advice of all of his top military commanders. And when he was not persuaded, Joab and the top commanders set out to do the job. And here we are given, in the verses following, for reasons unknown to me, the geographical route in which they undertook the work. Let me read it for you, and then I'm going to sort of trace it for you on our wall map. Verse 5. And they passed over Jordan, and pitched in Aroer on the right side of the city that lieth in the midst of the river of Gad toward Jazer. Then they came to Gilead, and to the land of Tatemhodshi, and they came to Dan-Jaan, and about to Zidon, and came to the stronghold of Tyre, and to all the cities of the Hivites and of the Canaanites, and they went to the south of Judah, even to Beersheba. Okay, map time. I didn't say nap time. Wake up. Map time. Except for the infants. Okay, they left Jerusalem, they crossed over Jordan, and they went down here to the Arnon and the Aroer rivers down here, and they started down here and started counting, went up to this area, which is called Gilead on other maps. Then they went up to, it says Dan-Jaan, which is obviously the most northern point, you know, it says from Dan to Beersheba, from north to south. So they went to Dan, they came all around here, and it doesn't show it here, oh, there it is, Tyre and Sidon are right in this area, and they came, and they were covering all this territory, sending those commanders out to take the census, and all the way down here, way down south off the map, Beersheba's down here, and then they came back up through Judah, and they came all the way back to Jerusalem, and they skipped this part here, which I'll mention on the tape in a minute. Verse 8, So when they had gone through all the land, they came to Jerusalem at the end of 9 months and 20 days. Well, I said that Joab's motives were pure this time, but as I read this verse, it occurs to me that in addition to the fact that it would be a trespass or a sin, maybe Joab did have a personal motive. He simply didn't want to be on the road for 9 months and 20 days. In other words, maybe he viewed this assignment as a real pain in the neck. He'd just as soon not do it. But he did it, in any event. And Joab reports the numbers to David. Verse 9. And Joab gave the sum of the number of the people unto the king, and there were in Israel 800,000 valiant men that drew the sword, and the men of Judah were 500,000. Just as an aside, if they counted 800,000 valiant men, I wonder how many cowards there were that they left out of the tally. Now, let's flip over to 1 Chronicles 21 again and compare the reported numbers given there. 1 Chronicles 21, verse 5. And Joab gave the sum of the number of the people unto David, and all they of Israel were 1,000,000 and 100,000 men that drew sword, and Judah was 430,000 men that drew a sword. Uh-oh. Looks like another error in the inspired word of God, doesn't it? Because the tallies don't tally. They're different. I think we all know by now that of the numerous places that superficially appear to be an error, there is always an explanation or some way that can reconcile two apparently conflicting accounts. I mean, what are we to believe? That God inspired the writer of the book of 2 Samuel to write down one pair of numbers, and then when God inspired the chronicler to write 1 Chronicles, that God forgot what he had told the other writer, and so God just had to fudge it to guess and hope nobody would notice? It's obviously a sizable difference. It's a total of 1.3 million men, according to 2 Sammy, and a total of 1,570,000, according to 1 Chronicles. So actually, there's at least a half a dozen good explanations. I'm just going to take the time to give you one. Let's look at 1 Chronicles 27, chapter 27, verse 1. This is talking about David's standing army. The King James Version uses the word courses, but I'm going to substitute the word division because these were large military units, and that would be the proper term we'd use today. 1 Chronicles 27, 1. Now the children of Israel, after their number, to wit, the chief fathers and captains of thousands and hundreds, and their officers that served the king in any matter of the courses, let's say of the divisions, which came in and went out month by month throughout all the months of the year, of every division were 20,400. In other words, the total army was 288,000. How do we get that? 12 months times 24,000 men in each division. Each division was on active duty for 1 month, and then it was free until their month rolled around in the following year, kind of in a way like our National Guard or Army Reserves. Now, it's clear that the Bible often rounds off numbers. And if we round off the 288,000 to 300,000 and add it to the 1.3 million given in Samuel, we come up with 1.6 million men. In other words, we're saying that the reserves were not counted in the other census. Then we simply round up the number in Chronicles to the nearest 100,000, and we come up with the same 1.6 million men. That's a totally legitimate explanation. And like I said, there are a number of others which offer equally valid means of explaining the discrepancy. But we'll move on for sake of time. Verse 6, back in 1 Chronicles 21, this is Joab reporting to David, and it tells us, "But Levi and Benjamin counted he not among them, for the king's word was abominable to Joab." Concerning Levi, God had told Moses that the Levites were not to be numbered. That's in Numbers 1, verse 49. Why did Joab not count the tribe of Benjamin? This is just speculation, but verse 6 seems to indicate that the reason has to do with Joab's distaste for the job. He found the assignment abominable, and therefore he dawdled and dragged out the job, hoping that David would change his mind and recall him from the census taking. But after 9 months and 20 days, Joab had already gone all around the land and circled down way down south and come back to Jerusalem. And so since he was passing through Jerusalem, or I should say, when he got to Jerusalem, he was really on his way to number Benjamin. That would be the last tribe, and Jerusalem is located in the tribe of Benjamin. And so I think he decided that since he was passing through Jerusalem, he'd stop in at the palace and report to David the total so far, again, in the hope that David would call a halt to the census. And sure enough, by this time, David has realized his sin and stops the count before Benjamin is numbered. Now, if you'll flip ahead a few pages to 1 Chronicles 27 again, I forgot to tell you to keep your marker there. We need to go there one more time. 1 Chronicles 27, verse 23, we will find support for this speculation. It says, "But David took not the number of them from 20 years old and under, because Yahweh had said he would increase Israel like to the stars of the heavens." Verse 24, "Joab, the son of Zeruiah, began to number, but he finished not, because there fell wrath for it against Israel. Neither was the number put in the account of the Chronicles of King David." Oh, I puzzled for a moment. What does that mean? Neither was the number put in the account of the Chronicles of King David. Well, sure it is. We just read Joab reported to him numbers totaling 1,570,000. Well, I think it has to mean that the complete number was not put in the Chronicles. It is not only missing Levi and Benjamin, but also those from 20 years old and under. And verse 24 verifies that Joab did not finish the job. I think verse 23 indicates that even in his desire to exalt himself in the size of his armies, David did not go so far as to demand that Joab number the youngsters, because it says, "Yahweh had said he would increase Israel like to the stars of the heavens." Well, so what? Someone says, why should that keep David from numbering everybody? Well, Remember in Genesis 15, when God had told Abram to go outside and look at the sky at night? Actually, it was in a vision, I think. Look at the night sky and count the stars, God told him, if you're able to. So shall thy seed be for multitude. The clear implication is that the total number of stars cannot be numbered. Just this past week, I read an article where some astronomer said that it is now a proven fact that in our galaxy alone, there are at least 10 billion planets, not stars, but planets. A couple of decades ago, astronomers could only speculate if there were any planets outside of our solar system. Now they verify that 10 billion planets exist just in the Milky Way galaxy itself. That staggers my imagination. What an awesome God we serve. What a creator. Listen to this prophecy now. You don't need to turn there. Which God gave to Jeremiah, who lived 400 years after King David. Jeremiah 33:22. As the host of heaven cannot be numbered, neither the sand of the sea measured, so will I multiply the seed of David, my servant, and the Levites that minister unto me. Did you catch that? It's not talking about about all the seed of Abram. It's talking about just the seed of David and the Levites is going to be like the host of heaven, which cannot be numbered. So if Israel was to multiply like the stars of heaven, and the stars cannot be numbered, then for David to attempt to number all Israel would in fact be an abomination bordering on blasphemy, wouldn't it? God says you can't number them all. It's like David saying, oh, I'll show you, I'll number them all. So David did not attempt to number the youngsters. Certainly, God understood, and we understand, that a ruler over a nation does need to know the available manpower for defense purposes. And so there is a balance that needs to be sought when the people are numbered. But David was numbering them more out of pride and desire to exalt himself than out of any real urgent military need at this time. And there is a second aspect to his sin, which we're still coming to. Let's pick up our text again in 1 Chronicles 21, verse 7. 1 Chronicles 21, verse 7. And God was displeased with this thing, therefore he smote Israel. Verse 8, and David said unto God, I have sinned greatly, because I have done this thing. But now I beseech thee, do away the iniquity of thy servant, for I have done very foolishly. Okay, let's now return to 2 Samuel 24 again and compare the parallel passage. By the way, I've read more than one commentator who asserts that David repented very shortly after he ordered the census to be taken. They meant like within days afterward, David goes, uh-oh, I've sinned. Now I tell you, brothers and sisters, just because some so-called Bible scholar assembles all his comments between the covers of a book and it's sold in the Christian bookstores doesn't mean that it's worth the paper it's printed on. I mean, that assertion is a gross error is a gimme. It's obvious. David could not possibly have repented until after Joab got back to Jerusalem after a period of how long? 9 months and 20 days. Because if David had repented sooner, he certainly would have sent a message to Joab to cease and desist from taking the census. Now, I found an interesting parallel here. You could say that when David was in sin, he was consistent in his stubbornness. He did not immediately repent. If you recall in our study entitled David and Bathsheba, tapes 420 and 421, we learned that after David had committed the fornication with Bathsheba, that he did not confess his sin until he was confronted with it by Nathan the prophet. And that, we calculated, was close to 9 months after the sin. So twice in the Bible record, we find that David remained stubborn and stiff-necked, refusing to admit his sin for just under 9 months in one case, and for 9 months and 20 days in another case. I have no light at this point on what the significance there is to the 9 months and 20 days. If we allow 30 days per month, then the total is 290 days. Is my math correct?